So we'll begin with the words of the Buddha. I'm so grateful to be with a group of people reflecting on impermanence. As funny as this may sound, this is a great thing. I mean, going to Hawaii or doing this or doing that could be really great, but gathering together to reflect on impermanence is not only invigorating or enlivening, but it's enlightening, it's liberating. It really frees us up. And this is our barometer, actually. You know, as we take up the study of impermanence for these 8 weeks, you can just see, you know, do you feel depressed or do you feel lighter? And if you're feeling heavy with the whole thing, then it may be that you're thinking about impermanence, which is different than reflecting on the way it is and the changing nature of the way it is. There's two different things. So we could spend 8 weeks thinking about how miserable it is that we work so hard to live and then we die. Or, you know, we work so hard in this relationship and then he or she left me. Or any number of ways we experience impermanence. I put so much time into this company and then I got laid off. So we think about those things and it's scary and we feel in a way betrayed by life. Like that shouldn't happen. It's not fair. But that's, I mean, you can do that, but in terms of the course, we're looking at the moment-to-moment reality, what we call the present moment, and whether we're observing thoughts or emotions or sensation or sound or sight or smells or tastes, we're interested in the dynamic, processed nature of all phenomena. And we're noticing, and this is the most important thing, we're noticing the effect it has on the mind. One of the things I will send out in the email and will get up on the website is an article by Ajahn Tanisaro, a well-known Western Buddhist monk and a very prolific translator and writer. And he's an article that's all about change, it's called. And he talks in this article about how often people misunderstand the teachings, the Buddhist teachings on impermanence. And it's not that these teachings are wrong. In a relative sense, they're useful. Like he gives some examples. He says, one example is, I'm just reading, insight into change teaches us to embrace our experiences without clinging to them. I mean, that sounds like good common sense, good advice. To get the most out of them in the present moment by fully appreciating their intensity in full knowledge that we will soon have to let them go to embrace whatever comes next. Go home, make a nice sandwich for ourselves. We have this attitude, it's not going to last forever. It will be nice for a while. I'm not going to cling to it. That's just good common sense. But that's not really the end of what the Buddha is teaching. He's not really even teaching that, although it makes sense coming out of the Buddhist teachings that you'd have that understanding that, yeah, things are changing, but I'll take what I get. You know, it's a nice day. I know it could be a worse day tomorrow, but I'll just appreciate what I have. I'm relatively healthy today. I'll appreciate that, knowing that it will change. And then he gives another example. He says, insight into change teaches us hope because change is built into the nature of things. Nothing is inherently fixed. Not even our own identity. No matter how bad the situation, anything is possible. We can do whatever we want to do, create whatever world we want to live in, and become whatever we want to be. So this, to some degree at least, is also useful, a useful thing to hold. Like, when we are in a really bad job, you know, not to feel like, that's it, I'm doomed, or a bad relationship. Because relationships can change. I mean, either you can leave the relationship or the relationship itself can be transformed. Same with jobs. You can either transform your relationship to the job or work with the powers that be and have them change the job or leave the job. So there is this dynamic possibility with whatever situation feels fixed or we feel stuck in, it is possible for things to change. And then the third example Ajahn Tanisaro gives is this sense, we've all heard this in different ways, he calls it a stoic equanimity, training ourselves not to get attached to the result of our actions and accepting without question the need to keep on producing fleeting pleasures as best we can, for the only alternative would be inaction and despair. Right? So, yeah, things are ephemeral, but that's all there is. So I'm just going to do my best to set in motion as many pleasant experiences as I can, even though I know that they're going to change. So Ajahn Tanisaro is saying, this is not the teaching that the Buddha uses impermanence actually as a skillful means to help us address a very relevant question that we all have. Whether you've actually heard yourself ask the question or not, we all have this question in our mind. You know, I mean, the simple version of the question is, what leads to lasting happiness? That's the simple version of the question. A more specific, technical version of the question is, this is what he writes, what, when I do it, will lead to my long-term well-being and happiness? What, when I do it, will lead to my long-term well-being and happiness? So the reason we're interested in change is we're interested in a happiness that is independent of change. I mean, aren't you interested in a long-term happiness? I mean, we settle for short-term happiness, I get it. I'm there. Many times today, you know. I mean, just, I observed so many times today, I did some exercise, and I normally don't do any exercise. It was nothing vigorous, but some of you maybe caught it. About a week or so ago, there was an article in the New York Times, and they're always one-upping these articles about, like, 7-minute workout. Did you see that?
I've done it several times.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? Today was my first time.
It is.
It's very, I can't say I did it completely. You're supposed to do each of these.
6 minutes.
You're supposed to do each of these workouts wholeheartedly for 30 seconds, then a 10 second break, 30 second, 10 second off. And I don't know, there must be like 12 of them or something like that. Anyway, see, where was I going with this? Oh, so I had a lot of energy today. After doing that, I said, God, this is better than green tea. I used to be kind of really into working out, but not in the last 15 or 20 years. Anyway, so I did my 7-minute workout. I was feeling like really alive, really high, basically. And I just noticed how I was like, just doing all these things. I do a little work on my talk, and then I go to something else. And I was just like moving around. And, you know, just that, it will be so nice to get that done. And just that pursuit of happiness. And there was always more to do. And so I was just observing that. I mean, I was feeling pretty good. It wasn't like terrible suffering or anything. But just the restless, uneasy quality. I mean, hating it wasn't the answer, so I didn't hate it. I was interested in it. And this is really what the Buddha would advise us. It's like, we're using impermanence as a teacher. It's a skillful means. This is the word he used a lot. In fact, all the teachings are skillful means. Even the idea of impermanence itself is relative. Impermanence is a relevant teaching for a human mind that has a strong tendency to imagine things are permanent. Then we need this medicine that things are changing, this instruction really. Check it out. Are things really permanent or are they changing? And it really helps us clarify this natural wish we have for lasting happiness. We want a happiness that's immune to change. I mean, it doesn't mean that we have to cease seeking things that are temporary, go ahead. But we should understand that it's temporary. And it's frustrating to always have to get another experience. It's never done. I mean, think about it. I mean, it's just amazing, even today, how many things I did today to be happy, to feel good. But then let's add up the days, how many things we did in the last week, or in the last year, or the last decade, or through our lifetime, or maybe many lifetimes. How many things have we done to be happy? And like, where is that cumulative effect? Well, maybe we feel exhausted, or frustrated, or who knows. But we should look, we should check it out. This is what Ajahn Thanissaro says. But the Buddha was not the sort of person to accept things without question. His wisdom lay in realizing that the effort that goes into the production of happiness is worthwhile only if the processes of change can be skillfully managed to arrive at a happiness resistant to change. Otherwise, we're lifelong prisoners in a forced labor camp, compelled to keep on producing pleasurable experiences to take care of our hunger, and yet finding them so empty of any real essence that they can never leave us full. These realizations are implicit in the question, according to the Buddha, that lies at the beginning of insight, which I just read. What, when I do it, will lead to my long-term well-being and happiness? This heartfelt question, motivated by the desire behind all conscious actions, right? It's really the seed of compassion, love, to attain levels of pleasure worthy of the effort that goes into them. Right? We've had a lot of pleasure that probably isn't worthy of the effort that goes into it. It springs from the realization that life requires effort, and that if we aren't careful, whole lifetimes can be lived in vain. Anybody have examples? I mean, maybe not a whole lifetime, but a decade? Like, how many relationships have we put a lot of effort into? And then what have we actually gotten out of it? Or working. I mean, one of the things that breaks a lot of our hearts is when we see people trapped in jobs that we would never want to have, earning just enough to stay alive, basically, and to keep doing what they're doing, working a job that we would never want to have. Of course, this is going on, I mean, maybe even the majority of the people on this planet, I mean, I don't know, but it's not a small number of people. And doesn't that break our heart to contemplate so many of us, so much of the time, are working really hard to be happy, that the effort to be happy, to get what we want, that pleasure, is so much greater than the pleasure that's ever gotten. This question, together with the realizations and desires behind it, provides the context for the Buddhist perspective on change. If we examine it closely, we find the seeds for all of his insights into the production and consumption of change. I like how he uses this phrase. So instead of the production and consumption of experience, he's saying that experience is really change. Any object of experience, any experience we've had, what we've created, you know, our actions create experience, and then we consume them. We made the decision and got ourselves a common ground, so in a sense we've participated in the production of this experience right now that we're consuming. And the way that we're consuming this experience, we're producing the next experience. So if you're consuming this experience in a way that's giving you indigestion, like you're frustrated by being here and hearing what I have to say, then that, you know, that's the production of your next experience that you're consuming. Now you're consuming the frustration. And then how you deal, how you relate to that frustration, how you consume that, is going to produce the next moment. So we're in this experience of production and consumption of experience or change. And this is in that chapter that Charlie's going to scan for us in Joko Beck's book, Nothing Special. She's one of the great early Western teacher. She's dead now. She died a few years ago. She was the lead teacher at Zen Center in San Diego for many, many years. And she has this chapter called, just Experience or Experiencing. And you can work with this in your sit, and then just more generally through the day. Am I having an experience, or is there experiencing being numb? And it really will reflect back to us whether we're in the world, literally trapped in the world of our ideas about things, or are we mindfully aware of the truth, which is the thing, everything is unfolding. Never really coming into being long enough to be a something. It's unfolding. And you can get little glimpses of this, but the mind initially won't like to see this because it's very unfamiliar to the conditioned mind. The conditioned mind has gotten deeply dependent on fixed notions. And that's why, of course, there's so much thinking going on, because it's through the process of thinking that we maintain the illusion of permanence. I'm Mark. That's what I thought yesterday. I'm Mark. So it's got to be the same thing. But actually, it's not the same thing. This, whatever this experience is that's being known, that I'm referring to as me, is not what it was yesterday. But that activity of the mind going, yep, it's me, that's the same. So that concept of Mark or me or common ground or car, that has a static flavor to it, even though it's just the thinnest veil on the actual experience, which is not the same. It's completely different. It's literally a different reality, even though on the surface, with that superficial attention, it seems like it's the same. Mindfulness breaks through this superficiality. It's really the point of mindfulness. So we're using impermanence, the nature of change, the underlying nature of change, both to contemplate in a very real, direct way how it is that lasting happiness, where is it that lasting happiness can be found? Because we keep, you know, we're working hard at lasting happiness, but we don't find it. And the Buddha would say, well, you're not finding it because you're not framing the question correctly. The question's right, like, where is there lasting happiness? But we have to remember, in this context of change, where is there lasting happiness? We have to remember the changing nature, because it adds important information to our pursuit of lasting happiness. It's like, eliminate so many possibilities. Like, don't look there, and don't look at ice cream. Ice cream may be sweet and smooth and cool, but it doesn't last. And sleep may be really nice, but it doesn't last. And moments of beautiful affection with another human being may be really sweet and wonderful, but it doesn't last. And the Buddha's not negating these things. But if we're truly interested in lasting happiness, we should understand the limitations of where we've been spending our time. Because otherwise, like Ajahn Tanisara says, we just miss the point. You know, how many days, how many lifetimes have been wasted pursuing things like wealth or whatever that doesn't lead to lasting happiness. So the Buddha, and Ajahn Tanisara mentions this in his article, you know, he talks about actions having four results. You can produce, you know, act in a way where you get a pleasant result. You can act in a way where you get an unpleasant result. You can act in a way where you get a mixed result. And then you can act in a way, and this is how Ajahn Tanisara describes it, the fourth, and a fourth that leads beyond action to a level of happiness transcending the dimensions of space and time. Sounds out there. Thus eliminating the need to produce any further happiness. So, here's another way of saying it. So this fourth kind of action with a fourth kind of result is the mind realizing an independence from needing things to be other than they are. Or a mind realizing an independence, no longer dependent on its conceptions of happiness and unhappiness. You get this in very deep states of concentration before the deep insight. But even in really deep states of concentration, some of you have touched these places in your sits, especially those who've been practicing for a while. And the mind becomes the heart becomes very still. And in that stillness, in that peace, the mind is not concerned with pleasure or afraid of unpleasantness. It's really left that behind for a while. That's what peace is. A peaceful mind, by definition, when the mind is at peace, it has some distance from its obsessive concern with pleasant and unpleasant experience. That's the very definition of peace. So when that's very profound, when that distance is great, and so that very deep conditioned tendency to be interested in pleasant experience and to be averse or not wanting unpleasant experience, it's like suppressed. It just can't be found in the moment. And the mind experiences a tremendous healing because it realizes this possibility of freedom. Even though it's temporary, it's dependent on the mind being concentrated, being really still. And then when you have to go back to work or have conversations or be out in the world, you lose that stillness. But there will be a little increase in faith and maybe even a residue of that peace, because it's hard to forget that kind of peace because it's different than the kind of peace we get when we're in that nice warm bath and the busy day is done and we don't have anything we have to do for 8 hours or 10 hours, and there's a little bit of relaxation. But in that relaxation, and that's real, I'm not taking it away. I mean, we like that, and it is healing to a degree. But there's part of us that understands, even if it's not conscious, that it's temporary, that I will have to get up, that eventually the bathwater is going to get cold, or the skin will shrivel, or whatever, you know, and we'll have to get out. And then there's that cold air. Already it's like, is it worth it, you know? So, let me read just a little bit more from this article. Because the activities of producing and consuming require space and time, a happiness transcending space and time by its very nature is neither produced nor consumed. So that's should be a little like, I'm not sure I understand that. Because the activities of producing and consuming require space and time, a happiness transcending space and time by its very nature is neither produced nor consumed. Well, this gives us some important description, like what we're looking for is not something the mind could produce or consume. Like, I can generate really exalted ideas in my mind, like the idea of all of us loving each other and being kind to each other and taking turns, you know, just creating a really utopian vision of common ground and how we are together. And that would create some pleasant feeling, which I would consume, you know, that vision, you know, I would consume it. But it involves space and time. It involves a conception. And that conception, me thinking that, imagining that, is subject to change. So it's inherently stressful, because I got to keep doing it in order to get, and each time I do it, I get a little less. So I got to change it a little. And all of that is frustrating and stressful. So whatever we're looking for, it has to be something other than what we produce and consume. And that's good. That itself is sort of interesting. Okay. Maybe that's why there's such an emphasis in meditation practice of not striving, because that would be producing and consuming something, like trying to get to some experience. And then he goes on, thus, when the Buddha reached that happiness and stepped outside of the modes of producing and consuming, he was able to turn back and see exactly how pervasive a role these activities play in ordinary experience and how imprisoning they normally are. Right? So let's just say there was this person or one of the people here in this room that have had some deeper insights. So not just the mind being still in a concentrated way, but rather the mind really seeing the changing nature, let's say, and because the mind sees the changing nature of whatever experiencing that is being known, sees the changing nature, and the heart becomes dispassionate. It's like things are processed, they're changing. Why resist? Why try to produce and consume? Because the production and consumption is always coming from a self, right? A self-centered point of view. Nature is trying to produce something or consume something. Like even a tree, you know, things that maybe aren't sentient in the way that we are, it's not trying to get big. They're just these natural and personal forces that are, you know, the river, Mississippi River, is not trying to get to the Gulf of Mexico. It doesn't have this production idea of like, just, well, at least get me to Hastings. And then we'll see. But we have the sense that I got to get myself through Monday, you know, and then Tuesday, and then, you know, I'm right in the middle of my 50s, getting myself through my 50s on to the 60s, and then there's this thing called retirement. I'm not sure where that is, but I have a sense it's somewhere out there, you know. So we have all these production goals and consumption desires. And so the practice is beyond that, and the Buddha stepped beyond that. And when he stepped beyond that, a very powerful insight arises. This is really what we mean by the fourth noble truth when we see the path. It's like we see how stressful it was being a producer and consumer. That identity, that mental construction of being somebody who has to produce something in order to consume something is itself stressful. So Ajahn Tanisaro again, he says, he was able to turn back and see exactly how pervasive a role these activities play in ordinary experience and how imprisoning they normally are. He saw that our experience of the present is an activity. Right? So we can observe this right now. Something fabricated or produced moment to moment from the raw material provided by past action. So this production right now that we're all involved in, how are we producing the meaning we have about what's going on? Well, of course, it's being informed from all of our past conditioning. The meaning that we're producing right now, hearing this talk, being in the room with each other, we're producing it out of the stuff of the past, all the way our mind has been conditioned from our past experiences. So we're producing it out of the past. We even fabricate our identity, right? Because that's one of the things that we've done this before, that had this sense of self. So the past is informing us now, informing this process now, and we're doing that again. We're constructing a sense of us, somebody who is here having this experience. We even fabricate our identity, our sense of who we are. At the same time, we try to consume any pleasure that can be found in what we've produced. Right? So whatever, like if you feel good about being here, then there's somebody that wants to benefit from that pleasant feeling that you've just created. Like, it's really good to be at Common Ground. I'm so glad that Buddhist studies has started again. Or the opposite. I always think, why did I sign up for this? So whatever your experience now, you know, then there's this inevitable consumption. And he goes on to say that sometimes we can't help but getting the unpleasant with the pleasant. You know, we can't tease out the two. Although in our desire to consume pleasure, we often gobble down pain. With every moment, production and consumption are intertwined. We consume experiences as we produce them, and we produce them as we consume. The way we consume our pleasure or pains can produce further pleasures or pains, now and into the future, depending on how skillful we are. So we might not be able to stop ourselves from producing, but we could begin to stop ourselves from consuming. So whatever we've produced, some feeling about being here, doesn't mean we have to take that personally. Personally try to avoid it if it's unpleasant or own it if it's pleasant. We could just let it be a production. Oh, the mind's thinking that. The mind's feeling that. So the real breakthrough revolves around this contemplation of impermanence. This is something the Buddha mentioned. I mean, when you read the discourses of the Buddha, you just can't imagine how many times arising and passing away, or some version of that statement, arising and passing away, is used to define or point to the insights that the women and men and nuns and monks had. It was seeing the arising and passing away, seeing the changing, impermanent, ephemeral, inconstant, insubstantial, not dependable nature of experience. Here's one of the suttas. Just as a farmer working after the rains with a great plow bursts asunder the spreading roots as he plows, just as a reed cutter, when cutting reeds, seizes them by the stem, shakes them around, rips them out, and casts them aside, just after the rains, when the sky clears of the retreating rain clouds, the sun rises up into the sky, driving away all darkness from the heavens, and illuminates, warms, and shines forth, so also the perception of impermanence, when developed and practiced, shatters all lust for sense realm, for the sense realm, shatters all lust for the form realm, shatters all lust for any existence or any becoming, shatters all ignorance, all and uproots all selfish conceits. And the neat thing about this emphasis on impermanence, you know, it's not that the Buddha is being optimistic or pessimistic. It's neither of those things. He's trying to use skillful means that help us to be realistic, you know, connect with things as they actually are. And to think of impermanence as a problem. So this week, we can really work with it as a teacher. See what happens when we start noticing the arising and passings. And you can just create little gimmicks at the end of a meeting. Just note in your mind, the meeting began, and now it's ceasing. Monday began, and now it's near its end. The afternoon arose, and now it has ceased. There is no more Monday afternoon. The meal began, and now it's over. And especially noticing the cessation. And then when you have time to practice formally, then as certain experiences catch the attention, so you're present, then because of the theme of the class, really see, rally the interest to see, can I notice when this thought is no longer present, when the breath is no longer present, when the sound is no longer present, when the pain is no longer present, or no longer the same. When we're superficial, it just feels like that pain in the knee is constant. It's just throbbing. But what's really constant, I mean, it's not really constant, but what it appears to be constant is the arising and passing of the thought, this pain is bad. And because that thought repeats and doesn't, it's static in the sense that it is the same thought that's coming and going, it seems like the pain is solid and permanent. But when we actually observe the pain with mindfulness, we see it's quite dynamic. It still may be intense. It still may be unpleasant. But it's not a thing. It's an unfolding process, pain is. This is from Thich Nhat Hanh. This will be in the email, this little passage. Nothing remains the same for two consecutive moments. And then he quotes I don't know how to pronounce this Greek guy, Heraclitus, said, "We can never bathe twice in the same river." Confucius, while looking at a stream, said, "It's always flowing day and night." The Buddha implored us not to just talk about impermanence, but to use it as an instrument to help us penetrate deeply into reality and obtain liberating insight. We may be tempted to say that because things are impermanent, there is suffering. But the Buddha encouraged us to look again. Without impermanence, life is not possible. How can we transform our suffering if things are not impermanent? How can our daughter grow to be a beautiful young lady? How can the situation in the world improve? We need impermanence for social justice and for hope. If you suffer, it's not because things are impermanent. It's because you believe things are permanent. When a flower dies, you don't suffer much, because you understand that flowers are impermanent. But you cannot accept the impermanence of your beloved one, and you suffer deeply when she passes away. If you look deeply into impermanence, you will do your best to make her happy right now. Aware of impermanence, you become positive, loving, and wise. Impermanence is good news. Without impermanence, nothing would be possible. With impermanence, every door is open for change. Impermanence is an instrument for liberation. So instead of it being a philosophical view, like I believe in impermanence, it's really a practice that leads to the end of clinging. So by observing impermanence, the heart ceases to cling. Observing impermanence is an action, right? We're producing something, and then what do we get to consume? The experience of non-clinging. This is that fourth action the Buddha was talking about. There are actions that lead to happiness or pleasantness, actions that lead to unpleasantness, actions that are mixed, little pleasant, little unpleasant, and there are actions that lead to the end of clinging, where the heart, at least in a moment, steps outside of the world of good and bad, outside of the heart being dependent in any way. And it's a different kind of experience. And the aftertaste of those insights is, I'm still a suffering being, you know, I still like this, don't like that, but there's a certain mistrust or sense that it isn't what it seems to be. My conditioned habits to seek out pleasant experiences and get away from unpleasant experience doesn't feel like a heavy trip. I don't quite believe it. I still will gravitate towards pleasant as long as I'm not harming myself or anybody. I still may gravitate to get away from unpleasant as long as I'm not harming anybody. But I'm not... My happiness is less and less dependent on whether there's a lot of pleasant or unpleasant experience arising. And that's the happiness, that's the long-term happiness we're actually interested in. A happiness or a peace that's independent of conditions. So just say a couple more things and then open it up for discussion. Just in terms of our homework. So practice seeing the beginnings and especially the endings of it, whatever you can catch. Just get interested in the beginning and endings. And then one of the articles I'll send you is a short article by Gil Fronsdahl. He talks about the impermanence of painful sensations. And so you can look at that because that's something that comes up a lot in our sits. Discomfort, and then just to bring that balanced attention, not the frustrated attention or the aversive attention, but a balanced attention to ordinary discomfort, not extraordinary discomfort, but just ordinary discomfort that you can be balanced with. And just observe its changing nature. We wanted to observe the changing nature of pleasantness, unpleasantness, and neutral experiences. so that your mind is getting trained to notice that all the full range of experience is ephemeral. That's her homework for this week. Next week we'll have small groups. So we have about 15 minutes tonight. We'll do a little chant at the end of this piece, so we'll maybe end a little soon, and I'll say a few things about this chant. But any questions about what I've said thus far, or specifically you might address the question, what is the effect of understanding that our experiences are impermanent, inconstant, not dependable? So in your own experience, like your experience of being angry and seeing the impermanence of that, or your experience of whatever.
Mm-hmm. So I was noticing tonight the guided sit, that's something I've noticed before when trying to see impermanence, that in actual sitting practice, formal practice, I tend to, you know, sort of try and keep some, like, the body in my mind, and then, you know, the breath is maybe coming and going within that sort of frame. And I don't know, and within that, I'm never sure, like, and then my attention kind of moves around within that, you know, like, it's not, I'm not, like, holding on, you know, focusing on one very specific thing.
Is your attention moving around, or is the experience moving around?
Well, that is what I can't tell the difference of.
Yeah.
Is that I can't notice if it's just that my attention is what's changing, or if the actual experience is changing.
Yeah.
Like, that is unclear. That was my question.
Yeah, well, that's a very good question, and you don't really need an answer, because the question itself will kind of make you interested to see clearly. And what makes it seem like the attention is moving around is because of the tendency of the mind to grasp, to get identified with the objects. So it creates the experience of friction, you know, friction's there. And so it feels like there's something happening, you know, that the mind is tight. And that tightness, we assume, is the activity of mind, of me doing things. But this is a nice thought experiment. This is Ajahn Amo says it this way. That, you know, when you're driving, like a passenger, not driving yourself, but you're in a car as a passenger, and you have the sense of, you know, driving from here to there. But you can, in a sense, relax your gaze and have the sense that the visual objects are coming toward you instead of you going towards them. It's all coming towards you. And that's a suggestion for, like, just generally, but specifically in meditation practice, that awareness is the space, this unchanging space. And then in this vast, boundaryless space, empty space, phenomena are coming and going. Sensations of the knee and thoughts and reactions. And all of that is moving, but the awareness isn't moving. Just the everything, you know, the all the objects of experience are what are moving.
So then it seems like there's, sorry to keep pursuing this, but I've had this for a while. So it seems like then there's two kinds of awareness or something, because there's maybe like a wider awareness that's not moving, but within that there's like a tension that is moving. And
yeah, but it might be just what you said, it might be tension. Yeah, I know, but it might be tension. That's actually what's moving. That's a physical, and maybe mental too. But, the mind does do these things. but is that the awareness that does that? Or is it some thought that's moving, like, I really want to focus in on that.
Yes.
I really want to see that. What's that? Oh, I don't like that. And it doesn't mean that it's fully articulated like that, and that you would actually notice those words moving in the mind. But that's actually, when you look, that's what it's doing. And you can just immediately catch it, because those things can be known. So that's how you know that it's not awareness. Because awareness can't be known. Because then it's not awareness. So if it's being known, if that movement of attention is being known, then it's something else. It's a thought, it's a reaction, it's something being known. Other experiences with change. Yeah.
I was really aware this weekend, Friday night electricity went out. And it, just the experience of being forced into a retreat in the sense of, no, you know, what am I going to do? Oh, okay, I guess I'm just here. And, well, when's it going to come back out? I don't know. And it's in the past, it would always be, I got to get on the phone right away, let them know that there's lights out. I can't sleep at night because I have to wear this CPAP and I can't have electricity. What am I going to do? And it was just this, I was aware afterwards that the whole experience, it was about 24, 30 hours before the lights went on. I was actually expecting that till maybe Wednesday in my mind, but I was like, okay, this is the way it is right now. But I wasn't aware of it until it actually ended, that I wasn't reacting during the time that it was happening. It was like, this is just how it is. And when it changes, it'll change. But it was the weirdest experience for me, because normally I get really anxious about stuff like that. I was just like, I don't know if it's because of my practice, what I've been doing, that afterwards I became aware that, I didn't react the same way that I normally do.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. Other thoughts? Sharon, and then over here.
This is piggybacking on what you were saying. I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying there. So awareness and attention are two different things, right?
A lot of times they're used similarly, but in light of what Jana was saying, I was saying that if you can notice the kind of attention you're bringing to an object, then that's not awareness.
Right. That's because I don't need to be doing.
Yeah, it's the way the mind is relating. So it's like a lot of the times when experiencing is happening, the mind is relating to the experiencing, and that's part of the experiencing, and all of that can be known. By what? Or we usually say by awareness. Or the Buddha, the one who knows, you know, that I'm having a fit, or I'm pretty peaceful. Mm-hmm.
Oh,
Casey,
sorry.
And then, I think you were going to be next. Say your name.
I'm Christine.
Christine.
I guess I've just been reflecting on this concept as you've been thinking and trying to figure out why, like, the paradox in culture in general, because...
Maybe a little bit louder, Christine.
There's this paradox in culture, our culture in general, where it seems like everything is always changing all the time, but there's also this expectation that everything should be permanent. Like, I don't know if other people experience that, but recently in my life, just personally, I have so many things changing all the time, just job-wise, career-wise, and it's almost, I have to make this, like, decision for myself, like, is this okay, or should I accept that this is kind of offensive because I can't decide on a career or something, because people are like, I thought you were doing this, so I thought you were doing this, or I just changed it, and so... I was just reflecting on that, how things actually are so impermanent, but we're just so good at not seeing that, or like saying that things should be permanent. I don't know. That's just what I was reflecting on.
Yeah. And just one piece I meant to say that I didn't, but I think it's important, is this world of producing and consuming, we can be participating in that world in ways that are very unproductive and frustrating, and ways that are relatively productive and pleasant. And the Buddha, you know, we're going to be making effort. You know, being alive, we're going to be making effort. So these are the four choices. And this one, it's subtle, to make the effort that leads to freedom. You know, that's going to take some time for most of us. But we can get pretty good at making effort, producing effort that leads us to consume something pleasant. And the Buddha names what that is. He says, generosity, leading an ethical life, and developing samadhi. These are efforts. You produce these things, you produce generous acts, or kind acts, or acts that lead to a real calm, balanced states of mind, and you will produce pleasant experiences that you can consume. They're still temporary, but they're relatively stable, and they're pleasant. So we do want to, we can't, because things are real impermanent, we have to be on the lookout for a tendency like, I just want out, you know, because that's different than dispassion. Dispassion doesn't mean you have to get out of it. Dispassion means you just understand what it is, but you're not afraid of it. You're not afraid of being in the ephemeral world. And that's a shadow to some of these teachings if they're not clearly understood. People get a little nihilistic as they reflect on impermanence. And so remember, dispassion isn't being averse to the changing nature or the ephemeral or the not dependable nature of our lives. Casey, did you have a thought?
Oh, it just keeps changing.
Good. Time for one more. Rebecca.
Over the storm Friday morning, we lost 200-year-old trees
In
our backwoods, and it changed my whole tree line, my whole reason why I bought my house. So just it's been interesting watching, and it's pretty cool that I only do programs after that. But, you know, my initial pain or whatever was, let's get a for sale sign. I mean, it was that intense, you know. And then when I was able to step away from that, then Friday being out in the nature, when I was able to look at the animals and connect with them and get out of my selfish view of I don't like to change the tree right now and look at what was happening with them, something shifted from clinging to something that felt, well, I would say I grieved, you know, I cried a lot, but it was a different, it wasn't that selfish I don't like this anymore. It turned into a freer, this is really sad. There's the trees were uprooted. It wasn't their time. You know, they weren't dead trees. They were living trees, and all these animals are out on this place. And then get into the act of taking care of what he did. We take care of the physical act of moving tree out of yard, things like this. I don't know. Something shifted. And when you talked about the clinging tonight, that's exactly what it was. Away from the clinging of my personal preference to, well, this is nature, this is what happens, and what is my job, what is my part in this to help the animals, to help, you know, the rest of the trees that are still alive, to clear away this debris.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know quite how to explain it, but there was this step away from this personal selfishness into compassion for the nature that was happening with the whole backyard system, the whole wildlife system. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have any better words to explain that, but there was a definite shift, and it felt free. It felt free compared to how it felt in the beginning. It was very oppressive feeling.
Yeah.
Like, I wanted a for sale sign, you know?
And we have these experiences all the time. That's the important point I think you're making, Rebecca, is that we see that the choice between suffering and non-suffering all the time if we look. And then the thing we're not doing as often is we're not distilling the wisdom that's available if we contemplate what's happening to us. Like, I just a teeny little glimpse of this is, I just noticed, I think I was driving and I heard on the radio that 400 trees in Minneapolis got blown over. And I just noticed immediately after hearing that information, a thought arose in my mind, why even bother? You know, that was just this primitive, conditioned response that for me, like, why bother to plant trees? They're just going to... And this is like, this is that aversion to change, like kind of seeing change and then seeing the aversion to it. And then I saw that, you know, I saw that was just a thought. You know, I didn't cling to it. But just to see our relationship to impermanence is what we want. There's so many little lessons. That's a bigger one. But we have this every day. There are so many different lessons we can have with impermanence. Even something like if you watch a TV show tonight after you go home, and when it ends, just notice what your relationship is to the ending of the TV show. So let's take a look for the last minute, and we'll just do this chant. This is a famous, well-known chant in Buddhist culture. There's a famous story, of course, at the time of the Buddha when he died, and it was a big deal, at least as the legend goes, and big enough that the supreme deity of all the universes, which is also a conditioned being like we are in the Buddhist cosmology, was so moved that he spoke some truth. And this truth is one of those statements I said gets repeated a lot. And so it's become the chant that's done often at funerals in Buddhist cultures. And so we chant it usually three times. In the translation, which is, you can see right now, impermanent are all component things. They arise and cease. That is their nature. They come into being and pass away. Release from them is bliss supreme. Another way that last line gets translated is something like, understanding this deeply is the greatest happiness, which is peace. But let's chant the Pali three times. Now, a lot of you don't know it, but you'll hear me and a few others, and you'll learn it, and we'll do it each week. Nicca vata sankara upadava yadamino upacituva nirushanti te sam upasamo sukho. Nicca vata sankara upadava yadamino upacituva nirushanti te sam upasamo sukho. Anicca vata sankara upadava yadamino upacituva niruchanti te sam upasamo sukho. In the English, impermanent are all component things. They arise and cease. That is their nature. They come into being and pass away. Release from them is bliss supreme.